Kim Hoggart is my guest today. A former US government official, she started her career in politics in 1980, working on the presidential campaign for Republican Ronald Reagan. After Reagan took office in 1981, Kim served in the White House as his assistant press secretary until 1985, when she went to work in public affairs for the then Secretary of the Treasury, James A. Baker III. When Baker became Secretary of State in 1989 under President George H.W. Bush, Baker took Kim with him, where she served as his senior deputy assistant in the State Department until 1991. Over the last two decades, since relocating to Australia, Kim has been an advocate for public education and Indigenous health and literacy programs. She joins me now. Kim, welcome to 2SER.
Thanks for having me, Tina. It's a pleasure.
This has certainly been one of the more remarkable elections in recent history. Taking it back 40 years ago to another remarkable election, you were with Ronald Reagan on election night in 1980, which would prove victorious for him in what is considered to be a landslide result. You've mentioned before that the slogan "Make America Great Again" actually had its origins within the Reagan campaign, and these two presidents have drawn comparisons at times. How do you feel about that comparison?
There couldn't be a starker difference between Ronald Reagan and Donald Trump. And the main thing that struck me in the beginning when Trump was running for president in 2016 was the negative manner in which he communicated with the American population. You know, Ronald Reagan, he had run a couple of times for the nomination, Republican nomination for president. But in 1979, 1980, towards the end of Jimmy Carter's presidency, there was an economic crisis in the United States. There was an oil crisis, and long lines at petrol stations. And importantly, there were 52 American hostages that had been held in Iran for 444 days. And this had been a constant problem in the Carter administration. And the president at that time gave a speech in which he said that the country was in a malaise. So there was just a real negative, downbeat sort of feeling across the country. And along came Ronald Reagan, who talked about mourning in America and talked about this great country that was a beacon, a shining city on a hill that attracted people from around the world to come and live in a place that offered freedom and liberty and justice and fairness and an opportunity. And Americans really responded to his message, and he was not called the great communicator for nothing. He really had an ability to communicate with the American public in a way that really resonated with them. It was a positive attitude, you know, and Donald Trump deals in the negative constantly. And I've always felt that was really striking difference between the two.
So, I mean, Reagan, in essence, I guess, was a president for all Americans, or that was the sentiment at the time. If you look at that election and the two that followed in 1984 and then in 1988 with George H.W. Bush, a sea of red basically swept America. Reagan won just about every state except for Minnesota and D.C. in 1984, and then Bush Sr. won 40 states in 1988. So when and why did the American electorate start to become so much more divided? Because it seemed to be much more collective during those years.
Yes, and Reaganism really took over the Republican Party, and it really was a party that had been focused on the economy, small government, low deficits, strong military, and an international approach, keeping America on the global stage as a global leader and superpower, and engaging in free and fair trade, and engaging with other countries through multinational organizations, a very multilateral approach. What didn't happen for a lot of Republicans and conservatives was addressing some of the social issues that they felt were being ignored, whether that was around abortion religious freedoms, school choice, crime, law and order. And over time, you know, when George H.W. Bush was elected, you know, he was considered a real moderate, and at a time when the world was changing enormously. We had apartheid coming down in South Africa. We had the fall of the Berlin Wall, new relations with the Soviet Union, and new nuclear arms reductions, treaties, and eventually the collapse of communism and the breakup of the Soviet Union. So this all occurred within just a matter of a few couple of years during Bush's presidency. And as an internationalist himself, he was the right president at the right time to deal with a changing world order. And I'm eternally grateful for the experience that I had working at the State Department during that time, when we also had the invasion of Iraq by Saddam Hussein and a real coalition, an international coalition, to remove him from there, which was very successful. But again, a lot of the domestic issues in the United States probably got superseded in attention by what was going on in the rest of the world and managing that change. And also, I think after two terms of Ronald Reagan and then a term of George H.W. Bush, there probably was a sentiment amongst the American people that it was time for a change, and Bill Clinton won that 1992 election and beat an incumbent for only the third time in American history. But I do think that with the introduction of Newt Gingrich, a firebrand Republican conservative in the House of Representatives, and a neoconservative tilt within the Republican Party that became more vocal, the discourse in America around Christian nationalism developed into a stronger voice within the Republican Party. And over time, between things like conservative talkback radio hosts, the development of Fox News in the 90s, and of course the internet and social media, we saw more and more of the Republican Party becoming factionalized into more conservative branches with the Tea Party and the Freedom Caucus. And all of this has just sort of led to this day in 2016 when Americans were tired of politicians who they felt were not addressing the needs of the American people. This was also happening on the left of the part of the Democrat Party, too.
Indeed. Yeah.
So this has been happening over a few decades, this disruption within our political parties. And I think ultimately led to somebody, an outsider like Donald Trump in 2016.
You just mentioned, you briefly mentioned just their media in terms of conservative talkback radio. And it just strikes me when you appeared on Q&A earlier this week, when the subject of media diversity came up, you lauded the fact that we have such a robust public broadcaster here. But I was interested to hear you refer to America's public broadcaster as a shadow of the ABC. I assume you were referring to PBS.
I am, in terms of the reach.
Right.
You know, here, I mean, I'm not saying there's a diversity of media in this country in terms of ownership. There's not.
No.
But what is protecting Australians from the disinformation campaigns, the brainwashing that has gone on in the media in America, I think, is the investment in public broadcasting here, and certainly responsible commercial broadcasters, but the fact that in the rural and regional areas here, where there isn't as much of a commercial interest, the ABC has been very important in keeping Australians informed about domestic and international affairs, and a balanced and presenting a balanced point of view, but also just the variety of content that's available through the national broadcaster, which we don't have quite that much in America, and the reach is, and because of the number of media outlets in America now, it's really you know, a small portion of the public that is getting their news or their information from that source.
Things are neck and neck at the moment, obviously, getting back to 2020. Biden is ahead in the Electoral College, but there's still a pathway for Trump to take the Electoral College. One thing is for certain, though, regardless, Biden will still win the popular vote, as Hillary Clinton did in 2016. That in itself would be historic for a candidate to lose the popular vote twice, but still be elected president. And it would also be the third time in 20 years that the most popular candidate again lost. You can see where I'm heading with this. Do you think it's time the Electoral College was laid to rest? And if it is time, how does America actually go about doing that? Because it's been discussed for years, but nobody seems to be able to explain how that would actually be able to be changed.
It definitely needs to be updated to the 21st century. Unfortunately, it's a massive, massive complex problem. And people don't really understand their own electoral system. So it's really hard to encourage people to accept change around that, because Americans are so wedded to their constitution and the importance of that. There's almost a sort of religious belief in this document. Even though it has been changed many times over the years with plenty of amendments, it's very hard and very fraught process. So yes, I think the Electoral College has become an anachronism. It favors minority rule, advantages minority rule in that states that have small populations can have just as much say or their vote has more value than, say, larger populated states. California, biggest state in the country compared to Wyoming, which has, you know, 500,000 people. Yet every state has two representatives in the Senate, the most powerful chamber in the Congress that will determine whether legislation gets passed or not into law. 500,000 people in Wyoming, their two senators, their vote actually has more value to the Wyoming resident than it does, say, the California resident. And that's just really not a sustainable option. And it's not just these two elections where possibly we've had a candidate win without a popular vote. It's happened for Republicans basically in this century. I don't think George W. Bush won the popular vote. So it's really not reflecting the will of the country. Also, it's not just the Electoral College vote. It's the gerrymandering that goes on, the political partisanship in determining the district lines that will determine how many Republicans, you know, can be represented in an area, or Democrats. It really needs an independent, nonpartisan national electoral commission like the Australian Electoral Commission. We just don't have these problems in Australia because everyone knows there's a referee and everybody abides by that referee, which is the Australian Electoral Commission. We don't get into the arguments about how districts and boundaries are determined. And really, a lot of the politics needs to be taken out of the electoral system in the United States. And it's a very hard thing to achieve.
You've also said that you think women would be the deciders of this election and that they would come out in droves for Biden. How do you think Biden has performed so far amongst women? Certain parts of the female electorate were obviously a struggle for Hillary Clinton. For instance, white women. How do you think Biden has performed with this part of the electorate so far?
Well, I haven't seen the final breakdown in all the demographic categories yet, but certainly, you know, women are the majority of the population in the United States. It's been African American women who have constantly delivered for the Democrat Party, and Donald Trump has lost some of the suburban women vote that he had in 2016. He certainly improved in Black and Hispanic voters from 2016. But I still think if Biden gets through, it'll be because he was able to attract more suburban women voters, and certainly the majority of African American women and other women of color. And also the youth vote will overwhelmingly go to Biden, and that will include a lot of young women. So I think his choice of Kamala Harris as his running mate also signaled to women in the country that he was serious about addressing the issues of women, whether it's pay inequality, reproductive rights, economic issues of all sorts, minimum wage for women, particularly women who are working in lower paying jobs in the service industry or teachers and nurses as well. So I think there's a real feeling that his administration will be looking to handle the issues that women have been talking about for decades with a real modern 21st century approach.
It's amazing to think. I mean, there was much made of the fact that Hillary Clinton, had she won, she would have been the first female president in the United States history. But if Biden wins, Kamala Harris will actually be the first female vice president in America's history. It hasn't been done before. There was Geraldine Ferraro running alongside Walter Mondale in 1984. And obviously, we all remember Sarah Palin alongside John McCain in 2008. So a female VP has been on the ticket before, but it's never come this close. Yeah. And it's amazing to think that it's never happened before. America is our most important foreign ally. How do you think a Biden presidency would affect Australia in both our foreign and domestic policy?
I think Australia would welcome a Biden presidency just because of a return to a more traditional American approach to international affairs. Biden is an institutionalist. I see him in the same sort of school as George H.W. Bush. Both of them have had a lot of experience in foreign affairs. Biden has been the chair of the Foreign Relations Committee as a senator, and also, of course, his experience as 8 years as vice president, but just his decades of experience in Washington. He's already indicated that he would be immediately rebuilding relationships with allies that have been strained under the current presidency. He has said that he would ring up NATO allies on the first day in Europe and say, you know, we're back and we're with you. And he'll move the country back towards a multilateral approach and engagement. He'll re-engage with a more global, free and fair trade system and new trade policies that would be less protectionist and less isolationist, as under the Trump America First agenda. And obviously the biggest elephant in the room for him will be dealing with an emerging China, whether that's on trade issues or the South China Sea. And that's important for Australia, regional security issues and a renewed focus on the Southeast Asia region in particular, and building relationships with countries in the region. And that's a real opportunity for Australia to play an important role. America has always, in my experience anyway, cherished the relationship with Australia. It's a close partnership. It's an important partnership. It's one they don't take for granted. It's not to say that what's affecting Australia or on the Australian government's agenda is always going to be top of the list in America in terms of their attention. But nevertheless, there's an indelible relationship that will remain strong and will probably be enhanced by a Biden administration re-engaging with the world. But having said that, you know, Biden has said he's going to join the Paris Climate Accord, rejoin it on day one, and that'll put pressure on the Morrison government to rethink their carbon emission targets and other aspects around climate change going forward in the next few years. But they would certainly be expecting that.
Biden, there's still obviously, Biden's leading at the moment, and there's a number of different pathways for him to reach the presidency. What do you think they will be? I'm talking now in terms of the options, you know, Pennsylvania, neck and neck, Arizona, neck and neck.
Yeah. Well,
Georgia.
that's it. There are basically six states left to determine the outcome. Alaska, we're not really considering because that's small, and that'll be in Trump's.
Yeah, I think the only time they've gone blue was 1964, all the way for LBJ. I think that's the only time since they were admitted as a state. If he wins Pennsylvania, obviously, that's 20 electoral college votes and
he's there.
Game over. But
game over. But he's, as you say, the former vice president still has more pathways. If he wins Arizona and Nevada, he'll get there. If he wins just Pennsylvania, he'll get there. Georgia, which is close, and they're still counting votes, but they're counting votes now that are in the Atlanta suburbs, and they're primarily mail-in ballots that would favor the Democrats. So that could be interesting. That could be a flip to the Democrats, which would be the first time. I don't know from when, maybe the Carter years. So that would be pretty extraordinary and is illustrative of the changing dynamics and the changing demographics in the United States. There are a lot of young professionals, a lot of African Americans in Georgia. And this is also the same in Arizona, where a lot of people from California have moved. It's no longer a retiree community. It has a lot of young professionals as well, a lot of Hispanics. So the dynamics are changing in a lot of regions in America.
That we saw over that in time, Texas, didn't we?
Yeah, and over time, you know, the numbers of favor the Democrats in terms of when people do get out and vote. Now, we've seen an extraordinary turnout, an historic turnout in this election. And the one thing you could say that Donald Trump has done is he's motivated people, Americans who are normally apathetic and only vote about, 55% of the electorate actually go out and vote. And he's motivated people so that we'll have an historic number of people that have actually voted. And the scene has changed in terms of how Americans vote. With this pandemic, they've voted more and more with other methods, whether it's mail-in ballots or voting early in person or dropping off their ballot to a ballot box. So that's a massive shift in how Americans have voted traditionally, and that'll be only a good thing going forward. But nevertheless, America remains a deeply divided country, and no matter who wins this election, there's an awful lot of division to deal with, as well as multiple crises happening at the same time with the economy and COVID and the racial injustice issues that will still need to be addressed.
Kim Hoggard, it's been an absolute pleasure.
Thanks for having me, Tina.
That was Kim Hoggard, former United States government official and a non-fellow resident at the United States Study Centre in Sydney. If you'd like any more of Kim's takes, she's just published two opinion pieces this week in the Sydney Morning Herald and The Guardian.